Vale, Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But I'm asking you to hold your calls for the time being because we have with us right now Dr. Miller, and we're going to be talking about, of course, genetic engineering. Dr. Henry Miller has been working with genetic engineering for some time. I heard him give an excellent talk this last weekend on that subject. Dr. Miller, thank you so much for being with us.
Delighted to be with you.
All right, fine. Would you like to just sort of introduce yourself to our listeners or where you are? You at what institute?
I'm a fellow at the Hoover Institution. I do research on science and technology and their regulation by the government.
All right, fine. Well, now, do you do genetic engineering yourself?
I did in its early days at the National Institutes of Health. Then I was at FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, for some years, and came to the Hoover Institution in 1994.
I see. Well, what years were you there at the FDA then?
From 79 to 93.
All right, fine. And of course, they were doing genetic engineering. When did genetic engineering really start? Was it about the early 1970s or when?
Well, that's an interesting question because it depends on how you define it. We've been doing genetic improvement of organisms, animals, microorganisms, plants, for a very long time, for literally centuries. In the 20th century, we did this with increasing sophistication and power as science advanced. But the kind of genetic engineering that you and I will be discussing this evening, variously known as recombinant DNA technology or gene splicing, originated in the 1970s.
All right, fine. And so we'll want to talk, you know, about the techniques so people have an understanding. Certainly, we've always had the breeding of animals. We've had the cross-pollinization of various plants and flowers and even, I'm sure, of vegetables in an effort to improve them. And, of course, this, in a certain sense, I'm sure you're suggesting is genetic engineering, but the recombinant techniques are something that are relatively new. And, of course, this is what all the questions are about. So you are working there at the Hoover Institute and, of course, trying to let people understand the very essence of what this is about?
Yes. I'm a physician and molecular biologist, but I'm not in the laboratory anymore. I simply analyze government policies and advocate rational and appropriate approaches by the government to oversight of these techniques, trying to make them consistent and logical.
Well, isn't that sometimes a little bit frustrating, especially with the massive bureaucracy? Are they making them logical?
It's quite frustrating. It's asking the government to be logical and reasonable and appropriate is what my colleague economist Milton Friedman says is like trying to design a cat that barks.
Well, Milton Friedman isn't at the Hoover Institute, or is he?
Yes, he is. Has been for decades.
All right, fine. Well, of course, I haven't been around up there. I was from Cal myself, so but we'll have to perhaps get some of the other people up there onto our programs, because certainly Milton Friedman has always been one of the men I've really respected through the years. We're going to be back in just a moment with Dr. Miller here, Dr. Henry Miller, right here at Radio Liberty. Well, This is Dr. Stan, and our guest this afternoon is Dr. Henry Miller. And Dr. Miller is at the Hoover Institute, and he, of course, works as far as evaluating government regulation of science. And, of course, this is really quite a problem because the government is interfering with every aspect of our lives increasingly. And we're going to be talking this afternoon specifically about genetic engineering. And of course, Dr. Miller has pointed out that there's always been an effort to genetically engineer, and by cross-breeding within the species, certainly by cross-pollinating within the animals, within the flowers and other things. We've been really trying to modify and improve products and animals for a long time, haven't we?
We have, and there are some very good examples that are particularly apt at this time of year, and those two are corn and tomatoes. Corn began in Mexico as a precursor plant called teosinte, and I wish your listeners could see pictures of teosinte compared to the modern varieties of corn that we enjoy. Teosinte has very little ear, and very little in the way of kernels, so it produces extremely little protein. And over centuries, farmers and plant breeders have managed to evolve that very primitive and only minimally useful plant into the various corn varieties that we enjoy today. And of course, there are many varieties that are adapted to different geography, different climates, and also different purposes. So the corn that's used for corn meal and or for feeding to animals is quite different from the sweet corn that we enjoy on a summer evening. Tomatoes are a similar story. Tomatoes began in the Andes of South America, and the precursor of the tomato really resembled, more than a food, it resembles a golf ball. It's hard, it's bitter, it's toxic, and yet farmers and plant breeders have been able, by trial and error and great skill, to evolve the tomato into the huge number of varieties that we enjoy for various purposes, and that has been adapted to different climates and to be resistant to diseases and pests. It's really an extraordinary story. And then you have the more modern end of the continuum, where instead of trial and error and brute force plant breeding, we've been able to move single genes from almost any source into corn, into tomatoes, into tobacco, into all sorts of plants to make them more useful.
I'm going to have to interrupt you there, because we're going to have to bring our last station on board right now. Well, Dr. Stan and our guest this afternoon is Dr. Henry Miller. We're going to be talking about genetic engineering, and of course this idea of being able to take genes and put them into plants, and of course we can take genes and we can put them into animals. We can of course begin to modify so many things. We can begin to modify bacteria and viruses. And first of all, let's talk a little bit about this this technique. How do you actually get a new gene into an animal or a fish or something like that? Don't you use a virus or a part of a virus or a plasmid or something like that to infect it, to take the gene in? How do you do that?
Well, you can do it in a number of ways. If you're modifying a microorganism, the easiest way is to use a plasmid, which is a circular strand of DNA that's like a donut that contains genes that will get the desired gene into the microorganism. You can also use a technique called microballistics, which basically takes little segments of DNA and shoots them into a cell. The various numbers of the pieces of DNA get in, and a smaller number still are actually integrated into the chromosomes of the cell. You can also use viruses, as you alluded to. We also use a trick that that takes a small segment of a plant pathogen called Agrobacterium, and we use that to move genes of interest into the genome of various plants. Once this is done, We do an extremely careful analysis, often including the DNA sequencing of the entire plant, to see how many copies have been put in to assure that we've put in only what we want to, and so on. And I would point out that this is a much more precise process and a much more concise process than is possible with the older techniques, which are often extremely crude and whose effects, unwanted effects, are often poorly understood or poorly known.
All right, so you can actually take and take something and you can put into a cotton plant so that it will resist the boll weevil or whatever whatever the pathogens are that the pests that would actually erode the cotton plant. Is that right?
Exactly, and cotton, since you mentioned it, is one of the great successes. We've taken a single gene from a bacterium that's toxic to certain cotton predators. Put it into cotton and made it highly resistant. It cuts down the number of applications of chemical pesticides that are necessary by more than half. It provides increased yields for farmers, decreased expenses, decreased pesticide use, decreased runoff into waterways, which is particularly important in places like the Sacramento Delta and the Mississippi Delta. So that has been an extraordinary success, one of many to this point.
All right, fine. Well, and then, of course, what happens, of course, when, of course, you're taking and you're introducing a gene into an animal or into a fish? I know they've done this with fish, and they've modified the fish. And, of course, people talk about the Frankenfish, the great big fish, much larger than ordinary because they had genetic changes. But would you use a virus or a plasmid or something as a carrier for the genes to alter the fish growth?
Well, you'd use it on the fish embryo to introduce these genes of interest in pretty much the same way as I described. You could do it with a virus, you could do it with this microballistics technique where you just accelerate the particles and to get them in. The fish story is an interesting one and still in its early stages, but it appears that you actually don't get larger fish than normal. You simply get them to grow faster to attain their adult size. And so there's a tremendous advantage there because you have less time you have to farm them, less time you have to feed them, less time you have to care for them to get them to maturity.
All right, fine. But then let's imagine you use a virus. What happens to that virus? You use the virus to get into the fish, and then, of course, and don't you sometimes have to break down the resistance, because ordinarily, of course, our bodies are built so that we don't want to take on outside genes. There's a certain barrier built in within us that prevents the things crossing the species barrier. So don't you have to somehow break that down to be able to bring these new genes in?
Well, these viruses are not infectious in the sense that you mean it, that our bodies have learn to resist. For one thing, it's usually done at an embryo where there is no immune response manifest. For another, these are weakened viruses that don't cause any widespread infection or toxicity. If they were toxic or dangerous, the technique wouldn't work. What happens to those viral sequences is that sometimes they are also carried along, but they are insufficient to cause a propagated or to spread infection.
Now, of course, how long have they done this, and do they follow them afterwards to be sure that there's no possibility for complications?
Oh, of course they do. And in fact, what's often not appreciated is the scale at which this has been done. For mice alone, for the construction of what we call transgenic mice, because these are mice with genetic material from distant species.
Was you're putting other species' genetic material into the mouse?
Exactly. And there are literally tens of thousands of varieties of lines of these mice. Those that are available for scientific research comprise a book that looks like a telephone directory for San Francisco. And these are The first transgenic mouse to be patented was one called the Onco mouse. It was created for susceptibility to breast cancer as a model to study human breast cancer, its mechanism and its therapy. And since then, there have been literally tens of thousands of these constructed for a variety of purposes in scientific research. And so we've been able to follow many, many thousands of animals through their entire lifetimes and their progeny through entire lifetimes and their progeny through entire lifetimes to look for untoward or unexpected characteristics. And the same with plants. Many, many, many generations of pest-resistant cotton and virus-resistant papaya and tomatoes and so on. And what we find is that, once again, with molecular techniques, these gene splicing techniques, we've done much more precise constructions that have greater predictability than the kind of genetics that we've done very successfully for a long time, but less predictably, less precisely.
All right, so then you can just take a gene that maybe, of course, will resist a certain type of infection in corn, and you can put it, now how do you get it in, certainly the corn doesn't have an embryo, did you put it in the corn seed? How do you get this chemical into the corn, and then how do you get it to reproduce?
Well, you put it into the seed with a vector, and you describe this as a plasmid or a virus that moves into the DNA and is incorporated there. And it's incorporated permanently, and then each time the embryo divides, each time the seed, the cells in the seed divide, they propagate the information that you've put in. And then, again, if we're talking about corn, that new DNA as well as the corn's own DNA is present in every kernel, and the seeds that are used for the next generation contain that information and so on. It does breed true and appropriately.
And of course, this gene then produces a substance. What are you specifically breeding into the corn? You're breeding in something so that it will not be affected by weeds, or won't be affected by weevils. Or what are you specifically putting into corn today?
It varies, of course, depending on the trait that you're trying to attain or enhance. And so, for the pest-resistant corn that we talked about. You're incorporating a single gene from a bacterium called Bacillus thuringiensis. And that bacteria, by the way, BT, has been available for 100 years in garden stores, and many home gardeners and commercial gardeners spray the actual bacteria on their plants and have done so for a very long time. Here, we're acting very much more precisely. We're taking one gene from this bacterium and inserting it into the corn to increase its own endogenous or intrinsic resistance to the bacterial to the insect pests. But it can be all sorts of things. We've introduced herbicide resistance in order to be able to use. Less toxic, more environment-friendly herbicides. In order to use herbicides at a single time of the plant cycle, we've introduced virus resistance. We've introduced drought resistance, and so on. An almost unlimited panoply of traits are available.
And so the amazing thing is they can introduce all of these things or very few of these things into almost any product that we're buying. We're going to be back in just a moment with Dr. Miller, and we'll be talking about, that's Dr. Henry Miller, we'll be talking about the genetic engineering, and we'll invite your calls here at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 here at Radio Liberty.
me help you to understand the nature of the spiritual battle in which we're currently involved is Gary Carr's book, The Demonic Roots of Globalism. Now, you may remember Gary Carr's book, Heir to Global Occupation. His second book, The Demonic Roots of Globalism, goes into the very real spiritual forces, the dark and sinister spiritual forces, which have energized those people who are molding the world in which we live today. Going into the background of Masonry, Theosophy, and he actually quotes extensively from the writings of these people who have helped to mold the events of the 20th century. The Demonic Roots of Globalism by Gary Carr will give you tremendous insight into the background of what's happening in America today. And unless you understand the spiritual forces at work, you really can't understand the unfolding of events. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR and ask for The Demonic Roots of Globalism by Gary Carr.
This is radio health journalist Bill Sardi. Hey, a lot of smart supplement users like to check out the facts before they purchase an herbal product. So go to www.lifespannnutrition.com and read all about Alamex, the new odorless, 100% pure allicin garlic extract imported from Great Britain. You'll find Alamex is equivalent to 15 cloves of fresh, crushed garlic. Check it out at www.lifespannnutrition.com or call 866-405-4000 to learn more about this breakthrough in garlic technology called Alamex. Call 1-866-405-4000 today.
All right, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I certainly want to mention some of the other products that we carry, and one of them, of course, is the Big Berkey water filter. And, of course, if you're out there across America, I think it, most people would feel a lot more comfortable knowing that they had a source of potable water, and we never know what the future holds. It's great to have it when you're in your recreational vehicle or camping, but it's also good to have in your home if there were some untoward event. And of course, the Big Berkey is what's been used by missionaries for really 100-150 years. It's a stainless steel attractive container which got two chambers. You put the water 2 gallons in the top, it comes out the bottom, and in the process it goes through ceramic filters that are packed with activated carbon. And it'll filter out the bacteria and many of the minerals and significant parts of the various things, the chlorine and other things that are in there. And, of course, people like it. The water tastes ever so much better. And you know that there's not going to be bacterial contamination. The Big Berkey, of course, is available for $239 from Radio Liberty. And if you buy it through us, you get a 4-tape set. And, of course, you get a video that we've produced. But these are not available, of course, in California or Iowa. They're available every other place. But here in California, there's something called the Berkey Light. And basically, it's made of lucite. It's transparent. The filters are different. They're called black Berkey filters. They're really much more efficient filters, but they have to be replaced every 2 to 4 years. And, of course, the advantage to the Berkey Light is, of course, it's $199. You get the same offer of a 4-tape set or a video that we produce. Go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. And look for the Berkey water filters we have there. And we hope, of course, you'll want to get one. They're available by calling 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And, of course, if you have fluoride in the water, while you have to get extra post filters, we can provide those for you. Give us a call, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Dr. Henry Miller, and we're talking about how, of course, they are able to do this genetic engineering and beginning to put individual genes very, very specifically into various products, and of course, to sometimes they can alter what the amount of protein in them or the amount of fat, or do we ever get problems when we do these things, these genetic engineering problems and processes, and get things we don't anticipate?
Well, at the very early stages, as with many experiments, some work very well, some not so well, some don't work at all. When we find candidates for commercial use for these products, they then go into a conventional plant breeding regime that is indistinguishable from that for conventionally bred plants. So we go to small scale to see that in under field trial conditions, the candidate variety does indeed do what we hope it'll do. And then it goes to larger scale and still larger scale under different conditions. And then finally, commercial scale. And then if it's a really good candidate, it goes to seed certification programs.
All right. Now, how long a process is this? How long does it take from the time that they, actually produce a product before it goes on the market?
Well, it depends whether we're talking about tomatoes or pea seedlings or corn or an oak tree.
Now let's talk about corn.
It would be several years at least. We'd need several growing seasons to ascertain that the characteristics are exactly what we want, that nothing inadvertent was transferred in, although that's, as I said, much less likely with these molecular techniques. And that the trait that or traits that we want breed true from generation to generation. So we can't rush Mother Nature in that respect, and we have to wait for several growing seasons.
But what about the impact on individuals? Do you try them, for any period on people to see if there might be a reaction in the individual rather than turn them loose on the entire population?
Again, it depends a little bit on what we're talking about. For a product like corn, which has virtually no known allergy, we would have a lower level of concern about that sort of thing. And there are not significant toxins in corn either. If we're talking about tomato, as with any new tomato variety, we measure for various alkaloids that can be harmful, like tomatine for squash and squash family. There are certain alkaloids that we look for. There are chemical tests that we do. There are assays for potential allergy. And we apply those as appropriate for any new variety, including those that are developed by molecular techniques. I should point out, though, that occasionally with conventional techniques, we've had new varieties slip through the screen because of the crudeness, the lack of precision of conventional plant breeding. And so we've had two varieties of potatoes that turned out to be toxic, two varieties of squash, and one of celery that had an irritant that was irritating to the skin to farm workers and to supermarket workers. Those kinds of undesirable traits being carried along are extremely unlikely, I would point out, with molecular techniques because of the precision involved and because of the very small amounts of DNA that are moved compared to conventional technology.
All right, let's go to Ben, and I don't know where Ben's calling from, and we probably won't have time to... Ben, if you have a question, let's ask it. We may not have a time to get an answer
okay.
Right now.
My question, the thing is this, sir. This genetically engineered food is not proven viable for human consumption. When you talk about Roundup Ready corn, that's pesticide poison bred into the corn, and when you talk about the genetic engineering by introduction of a virus, that's the very definition of a cancerous tumor. And this kind of things, I'm sure that Monsanto and DuPont is paying Mr. Miller very well.
No. He is not employed.
He's an advocate, though.
Right. But he has a right to be an advocate, Ben.
I grant him that, but let's use a proven science, because if mine and your kids, they're going to eat these genetically engineered salmon, and look at all the damage going on with the meat hormone and bovine growth, where our children are getting obese, they're getting tumors, they're getting sick. And it's just because the wonderful beef grown in Montana is sold in Japan, and the crap they're feeding our kids is grown in Panama, and they feed it anything.
Ben, hang on, because we got to go to a break.
I'll leave it there.
All right, fine.
Thank you very much.
And we'll ask Dr. Miller to answer that.
This is for human consumption.
Okay, we'll ask Dr. Miller to answer that when we get back.
Thank you, sir.
Now, of course, we're going to have to go to our break.
Thank you, sir.
Have you ever wondered what really happened at Waco? Have you ever wondered if maybe the government was not giving you the full story? Well, that is the most amazing video. It's called Waco, the Rules of Engagement, 2.5 ripping hours of the story of a government onslaught under a group of peaceable people. Well, their religion may be different than yours and mine, but they were still Christians, they still believed in the Bible, and they believed that the government would one day become their enemy and destroy them. Well, Waco, the Rules of Engagement is a video that everybody who loves freedom should see, because the ultimate conclusion is the government did not want them to come out. The government did everything they could to keep them from coming out, to antagonize them, loud music, lights all the time, to totally create a situation where they could not think clearly or respond normally. Waco, the Rules of Engagement is currently unavailable to regular sources. Call 1-800-5-HIBR right now.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I just want to tell you about another couple of products that we carry. Certainly one of them is a Miracle 2 soap products, and we can't make any claims for those, but we can tell you that many of the people who use them certainly do. And if you'd be interested in knowing more about them, I would be glad to send you information. There's a soap, there's a moisturizing soap, there's a lotion, there's a gel, and certainly there's a neutralizing solution, and basically it's a very alkaline solution, and a lot of people take that because it helps their heartburn, and we get all sorts of stories of really wonderful things that these products do. I know I have an Alecranon Versa, which, you know, as an orthopedic surgeon would ordinarily take out, but we've been putting it on, and I feel better now. We can say, well, it's not very scientific, and, well, all I can do is suggest, if you'd like to know about Miracle 2 soap products, or maybe like to get an introductory offer, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and ask for certainly the introductory packet, or maybe you'd even like to get a discounted introduction to the Miracle 2 soap products. And then, of course, I want to tell you about Phonopoly. Phonopoly is a wonderful means of teaching your children and your grandchildren how to read phonetically and pronounce words phonetically. And, of course, you can get the Phonopoly simply by giving us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and you'll teach your children how to read and spell and pronounce words phonetically. We also carry the Robinson Homeschool Curriculum. It's on 22 CDs. And, of course, for $199.95, why, you can get the education that will take your children from grammar school all the way through high school graduation, designed by Dr. Art Robinson. He used it with his children. There are over 50,000 of those out across America. A couple of years ago, we recommend Phonopoly. We recommend the Robinson Homeschool Curriculum. Well, Dr. Stan back here, and our guest is Dr. Henry Miller. And Dr. Miller, of course, you heard what Ben said, and Ben was Ben feels very, very deeply about it. He's concerned about some of the things that are happening with the growth hormone they're giving to our cows, and of course, what are the effects of some of the various hormones are giving the cows before they're eaten, but that really is not what we're talking about. You're not here to defend everything that goes on. You're here to talk about genetic engineering, and you're not employed by Monsanto or some other organization, are you?
No, I'm not, and I do not have any support from, nor have I ever had support from any of the agribusiness companies that do the kind of research we're talking about.
All right, so you just believe it's a good idea, and that's and you're really a researcher. Now, are you a physician as well as a PhD? Or?
I'm a physician, and I have a master's degree in molecular biology. I should say, to clarify for your listeners my own motivation, I'm not even particularly an advocate of this technology or any technology. What my goal here is to ensure that we have public policy that treats science and technology in an appropriate way and gives those products that turn out to be safe and effective and useful and that people want a chance to thrive in the marketplace. And that's not what we have today in public policy, in government regulation of these products. In fact, as you often point out, we have an imperfect government system. Government makes mistakes. It's sometimes excessive. It's sometimes too intrusive. But it's unusual as in the case of biotechnology, of genetic engineering, of agriculture products. It's unusual for the government to be 180 degrees out of phase with what the science tells us we should be doing. And so USDA, EPA, FDA all have regulatory regimes that discriminate against these more predictable, more safe, more advanced products. A hugely discriminatory regulatory regime that makes these products extremely, extremely expensive to develop and subjects them to excessive government scrutiny at every stage.
All right, well, how would you counter the argument that Ben would probably make about, say, the Roundup-resistant corn? And, of course, the whole idea is that ordinarily you spray Roundup on a weed and it dies. You spray it on the corn and it dies. But if you can, of course, put the genes for Roundup resistance into the corn, then, of course, you can spray and you don't have to worry about it destroying the corn. So what is the effect of getting this Roundup-resistant gene into the corn that we will be ingesting?
Well, there's no effect on the quality or the taste or any other characteristics of the corn, except that it makes them resistant to an herbicide, and that's the beauty of it. It's that it enables the farmers to grow their crop more effectively, more cheaply, and more safely. Roundup is glyphosate. It's degradable. It's water soluble. It's a much safer herbicide than many of the others that have been used in the past. It also enables farmers, because they can use the herbicide at one time, a particularly sensitive time for weeds of the growth cycle. It makes the farming more amenable to no-till farming. That is, you don't have to till the soil, and you reduce soil erosion in that way. So it's advantageous in several ways. Also, what one has to remember, what critics of new technology, and particularly this technology, sometimes seem to think, they seem to think that farmers are stupid and that they'll embrace a new technology because they've been sold a bill of goods by the agribusiness companies or by public policy wonks. It's simply not true. Farmers are extremely conservative, and what they most often do when confronted with the possibility of a new technology is they try a little bit at a time to see whether they like it. And what people like me are arguing for is that the government treat these new technologies in a fair and equitable and science-based way in order to give farmers the choice of whether they want to use these products or not, and then consumers the choice of whether these products suit them in the marketplace. But again, I'm not an advocate of any particular product or technology. I'm an advocate of reasonable public policy.
Well, I certainly, nobody can question reasonable public policy, but let's just take the Roundup-resistant corn. Now, what is the long-term effect of us ingesting the Roundup? I know, for instance, when I was practicing medicine, I saw at least one man who had a progressive neurological problem from inhaling a large amount of the Roundup product. So it's not a completely innocuous product, and they tell you to be very careful with it. What happens when we get that gene inside us? In other words, what impact does it have on the human being?
Let's be clear that the gene that's introduced into the corn or whatever the product may be makes the plant resistant to the herbicide.
I see.
The Roundup.
Okay, right. Okay.
But the herbicide is regulated by the government very, very stringently itself, and residues are essentially impermissible. Only extremely tiny amounts of the pesticide or herbicide are permitted, and when we look and see how much there actually is, these amounts are way, way below even the permitted tolerances. So again, we're talking about adding one gene, usually a protein, to the corn that makes it resistant to the herbicide or makes it resistant to pests. And this is one protein of tens of thousands that are present in the corn or tomato or whatever anyway. And the long-term effects are nil.
How do we know that? Have we run any studies on human beings to find out if that's true?
Well, the answer is no, because you'd need to give humans thousands of times the dose that they would receive. But we have done the experiments in animals, in mammals, of course, and there is absolutely no discernible effect at all on these, except that they're in many cases they're getting a little bit of extra protein.
All right, fine. Let's go to, is this Mark? Is this Mark or is this Roger?
I have Roger.
All right, do you have a question or comment?
Yes, thanks, John. Well, I kind of want to go from more innocuous to more deadly, but I want to jump in with this question first. I mean, you either subsidize a farmer to grow, say, whether it's canola or whatever that's engineered in this way, and therefore his neighbor farmer, if he beats him out on even slightly higher yields, is he not almost economically forced just to stay competitive to adopt the same seed? And then there's a case of at least one court case, I understand, in Canada, where the neighbor farmer was sued for stealing the pollen, replanting his seed, in other words, from the adjacent field. And I think there are cases pending in the United States as well, but I understand the Canadian farmer lost.
All right. Well, let's ask that. Thank you so much, Roger. And basically, of course, the story that Roger is telling, of course, apparently these traits get into the pollens, don't they? And they can spread from one area to another?
Well, they can. I'm glad that the caller mentioned canola for a couple of reasons. Canola is a fascinating story. It comes from rapeseed. Rapeseed is a grain that was used to produce an oil, has been used to produce an oil for many, many decades. And we found that the rapeseed oil was useful as an industrial lubricant, but when consumed by humans, it caused heart disease because of toxic amounts of a compound called erucic acid. And so Canadian plant breeders developed a variety of rapeseed that had low erucic acid and that they called canola, which of course is very widely used as a cooking oil. But we still use the original rapeseed to produce industrial lubricants. And so farmers know that they need to keep these two varieties separate. They know the separation distances that are necessary. And we know it for other things as well. So, for example, to keep corn pollen from cross-fertilizing, from contaminating other varieties, you have to separate it by 660 feet. And for watermelon, it's something like a mile. And we know the numbers for the various crops. So farmers do this routinely and without difficulty, but for commercial reasons generally. Only rapeseed canola is there a safety issue. Your caller also brought up the issue of competition, of one farmer needing to keep up with the other and being forced into certain techniques or technology. That's the beauty of the free market system. That's the beauty of the freedom to do things the way that you want to do them. If you want to plant heirloom tomatoes, and you don't want to use those that have been developed to be resistant to viruses and fungi, you don't have to do it. You can try to sell those heirloom tomatoes for a premium, even though they're more expensive to grow. It's the same with tractors. It's the same with pesticides. If you think you can grow organic produce more cheaply, more effectively, and create a premium in the marketplace thereby, you can do that. All that I'm arguing for is that the government treat new technologies fairly and equitably in a science-based way, and then let farmers and consumers dictate their wants and needs in the marketplace, and thereby decide what thrives and what doesn't.
Well, one question I'm sure that somebody would like to ask is, since the pollen can spread these, what happens if the pollen from this Roundup-resistant corn gets onto a weed, and now we have a Franken-weed? In other words, we got a weed that's now Roundup-resistant. Is that theoretically possible?
That's a fair question, and if that were to happen, we don't have any sort of safety problem. We just have a problem of efficacy, of how then to kill the weeds. And then we need, if that should happen, we need to move to another less desirable, less easy herbicide in order to kill the weeds. But in the meantime, we will have gleaned all of the benefits of the Roundup resistant crops, which is indisputably a good thing.
All right, let's go to Mark calling. Hi, Mark. Did you have a question or comment?
Yes, I do. Very interesting program today. Really good information. I would like to get Dr. Miller's opinion on something real quick here. Leviticus 19:19, where it says, "Thou shall not let thy cattle gender with a diverse kind. Thou shall not sow thy field with mingled seed." And I'll take my answer over the air. Thank you.
All right. Well, I'm not sure. Mark, what is your point?
Yes. Well, I was wondering if this in some way conflicts with God's law that was laid down in Leviticus, but I'd like to get a more, you know, some opinion on this, because I'm not quite sure.
Well, I will ask Dr. Miller if he wants to comment on that.
Well, there's an interesting question buried there, and I can't give you the definitive answer to that question, but I can tell you that when we look at DNA sequences, as we have now, of many, many diverse organisms, we find identity is shared in many genes. And so if you look at the Japanese researchers recently completed a sequence of E. coli, the laboratory workhorse bacterium that's found in the gut. And if you look at the sequences and you compare them in a database to DNA sequences that are found elsewhere, you find that E. coli has identical genes to humans, to other mammals, to other unrelated bacteria, to amphibia, to insects, and so on. And so there is tremendous diversity in the genomes. I should say there is tremendous shared identity in portions of the genome throughout all of God's creatures. So I'm not sure what that tells you about the kind of diversity and heterogeneity that you're asking about. If anything, I think the answer to your question may lie in farming practices about what a farmer chooses to put into the field, and I think that probably is the ideological reason, the etymological reason for that admonition, that it's a whole lot easier and more effective to farm when you have only a single kind of plant, a single variety in a given field.
All right. Well, I tell you what, you know, is we see this magnificent design that is in nature, and we see the design of the chromosome and the individual genes, and we find that that little E. coli bacteria has some of the same genes that you and I do. That is amazing. There has to be a master design behind this whole incredible thing. I don't know how anybody could look at what we're learning about the genetic makeup of things and not realize that there has to be a designer. This couldn't have happened by accident. But that's we don't want to get into the theological discussion here. Well, we're just about out of time. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners?
Once again, the objective of the work of many of those of us who study public policy and propose modes for reform, models for reform, is not to advocate a single technology or a group of products. It's really to try to get the government to to be more rational and logical and science-driven in its public policy. And we've had extremely poor luck with that in this one area of genetic engineering used to produce plants and microorganisms and animals. And but I continue to be cautiously optimistic that with the support of the public and the continued interest of the scientific community, that we'll get there.
Well, I certainly hope you're right. I practiced medicine for many years. I saw what government interference did in the practice of medicine. Pretty well destroyed it. Doctors, my contemporaries, all want to get out. They live in constant fear. You put down the wrong number, they can come in with a SWAT team, simply the more regulation you have, the more problems you have. So thank you so very much for being with us. Our guest has been Dr. Henry Miller. It's been a fascinating time. I really appreciate you being with us. Thank you so much.
Delighted, Dr. Stan. Thank
Bye-bye.
You.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, fine. Well, I hope you enjoyed the program. I don't have all the answers. I'm concerned about, well, if you read my newsletters, you know what I'm concerned about, but there may be some good things. We'll have to decide. We'll get somebody on the other side and discuss the whole issue. Be right back.
Have you ever wondered about the boys we left behind in Vietnam and Korea? Did you ever know that we left 25,000 American boys behind in Russia, in Siberia, at the end of the Second World War? Have you ever wondered what really happened in Oklahoma City, what really happened with the TWA 800 on the roof alarm of the eastern coast of Atlanta? Well, ladies and gentlemen, all of the subjects are well covered in a fascinating book by Craig Roberts entitled The Medusa File. Call 1-800-5-HIV or order The Medusa File. Actually, Craig Roberts was a police officer working with the Oklahoma City bombing. And this book has been suppressed very effectively across America, and it's self-published, but I promise you that there's no other book in the world that will give you a more contemporary history, frightening history that every American needs to know. Call 1-800-5-HIV or
this is Dr. Stan, and I want to mention if you're out there and you're struggling with healthcare costs, why, of course, we hope that many of you will give serious consideration to a Christian health cost-sharing program. It's called MediShare. Now, it's a Christian health cost-sharing program, and I think it's an excellent opportunity to get a much cheaper health insurance. If you'd like to know more about MediShare, give us a call at 1-800-5-448-927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Would you like to know what really happened on September 11th of 2001? Well, you really ought to see my video, and it was called 9-1-1 Prior Knowledge. 9-1-1 Prior Knowledge. And, of course, how did, of course, Osama bin Laden come to be the head of this whole Islamic terrorist movement? Who is the blind Sheikh Omar Rahman? How did he happen to get to the United States when he was known to be advocating terrorism? There's so many unanswered questions out there. And in my video, and it's 2 hours and 20 minutes of me talking, although we do have a lot of other things we flash up on the board there, but you'll get a lesson in history, which I think is unparalleled. So give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and ask for my video, 9-1-1 Prior Knowledge. And then, of course, the Iraq, the Untold Story is still a wonderful, wonderful video that will take you into the real reason why we went to war with Iraq, having very little to do with anything you've ever been told before. That's Iraq, the Untold Story. You can get any five of our videos for $69.95. Just give us a call at 1-800-5-448-927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and ask for the video special, and you won't be sorry that you did. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course this is the time I have to remind you Radio Liberty is listener supported, and we do hope that many of you will decide right now you're going to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters and help us as we reach out across America. 5 hours every day, and about, 59 different outlets every week, just counted them. Now, of course, we're talking about internet and satellite and people that only carry us maybe half an hour a week, but at least they're hearing the truth they're not going to get from the controlled medium. If you'd like to be part of our program, give us a call, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Would love to welcome you into the Radio Liberty family. If you'd like a free copy of our June newsletter that deals with why we have, of course, all the new diseases, why, of course, we have the antibiotic-resistant diseases, why we have, of course, the cancers as prevalent as we do, just call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Ask for a free copy, of course, of our June newsletter. We'll be glad to send it to you. Of course, we hope you want to subscribe, but we'll be glad to send you a free copy. And then, of course, we want to mention Alamax. It's a wonderful, wonderful product. And, of course, it's a garlic product. And garlic's good for your circulation, for your cholesterol, for your blood pressure. And I've taken it for, well, about 9 months now, and I've been almost free of any colds or upper respiratory infections. So if you'd like to try it, call 866-405-4000. That's 866-405-4000. We do hope that many of you will want to set up an Institute of the Constitution in your community, in your church, and get out the most carefully kept secret in America, the secret of America's Christian Foundation, and why we're losing our freedom. You have to understand the Constitution, why it was written as it was, the Declaration of Independence. Call the Institute of the Constitution at 410-760-9068. That's 410-760-9068. I want to mention Phonopoly, which is a wonderful program to teach children how to read and spell and pronounce words phonetically. And most of the programs that do this will cost you $400, $500, $600. This is $139.95. It's 5 board games, 2 bonus games. We throw in a couple of books with that. Phonopoly has helped not only children, but even older people to learn how to read and spell and pronounce words phonetically. If you'd like, of course, to find out about getting a supply of food on hand or the things that you'd need if there were a real emergency, why, give us a call and we'll send you a ready reserve food catalog. If you're struggling meeting your health care costs, and of course, you'd like to know about a Christian health cost sharing program, that's a Christian health cost sharing program, give us a call and we'll tell you about MediShare. Go to our website at radioliberty.com, and if you go there, you can actually see pictures of the various types of Berkey water filters, and of course, if you buy them through Radio Liberty, you'll get a 4-tape set or a video free of charge. Radioliberty.com, you can listen to our programs there 5 hours a day and not get anything done, but tell others about our website. Tell others about the letters. We have all of our letters up there, and you can study any one of those letters. You'll learn an awful lot about any specific subject. And then, of course, tell them about our radio programs. Try to get people listening, and they'll start out thinking we're crazy, and, well, after a while, we're sort of hoping that they'll realize that we're not. And they'll begin to become involved in educating others, and that's how we're doing it, people telling people telling people. So your job is to get other people to listen. My job is to convince them that they're not getting the truth from the controlled media. And in Russia, it's entirely different. In Russia, everybody knows the media is controlled. They know it's lies. Here, of course, the people, unfortunately, believe that they're getting the truth. So tell others about our programs and pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders. Pray for our ministers, because they should be leading the spiritual battle. And lastly, we ask you to pray for our ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time when we'll be with you once again, may the Lord be with you.